Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Stephen Lubar, a former museum curator and director, who is professor of American Studies at Brown University. And we're continuing our conversation about Inside the Lost Museum, curating past and present. Stephen, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again about this book.
And I'm delighted to be back.
Now, as I mentioned in the last interview, we could literally do a show about every single section of this book. It's that there's that much information. And one chapter that I really found fascinating was Into the Storeroom. So we're going to start. What are collection storeroom? This is like the hidden parts of a museum.
That's right. Behind the scenes of the exhibits and the offices and the gift shop, most museums have storerooms, basically rooms full of shelves or racks for pictures. And most of the museum's collections are in those storerooms. In a natural history museum, it might be 99.9% of the collections are there. In an art museum, 90%. History museums, often less. But there's the collections are there not just for display, but for research and for long-term preservation. And there are a billion objects in American museums, and I would guess that 990 million of them are in storerooms.
Now, there's a whole atmosphere that the public thinks that the storerooms are about. I mean, if you've seen Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark of the Covenant, you know, you have this vision of this vast, dark warehouse where all the really cool stuff is being kept under lock and key so you don't see it. It's like there's the stuff that the museum doesn't want the public to know about. But what are they really like? They are like that, right?
Well, I'm told that scene was actually filmed in the museum storeroom.
No! No, wait a minute.
That's the story that I'm told. I don't know if it's true or not, but it could be. It looked, a modern storeroom is often full of created objects. They're kept safest and easiest to move if they're crated up. And so museum objects, history museums objects especially, are crated and put in storerooms and moved around by forklifts. So that could have been real.
Oh, my God.
I should back up, though, and say that while that's the image that many people have of museum storerooms, the surveys that have been done suggest that many visitors have no idea that museums have things that aren't on display.
Well, you know, this brings up an interesting point. And because this is the second show, we need to talk about Jenks and his museum first. Jenks had the museum that was at Brown University. And this was an early museum. It was in the late 1800s. He had no storeroom. This is the thing that I found amazing. Everything that he acquired, he put on view.
Right. As soon as he could. He was always sort of trying to catch up with things that were coming in crates and he had to store in the basement. But as soon as he could, he would build new exhibit cases and put things on display. And that was fairly common for natural history museums, anthropology museums, even art museums of the late 1800s. The idea was you would put everything out there and anybody wanted to come and look at it. It wasn't until the 1860s that a curator at the British Museum said, you know, nobody's really getting good use out of having everything crammed together in the public. The scientists, they want to look at things in more detail. They want to have lots of examples of the same specimens, the same species, say. The public wants more space. They want to be able to see things better. And so he came up with the idea that there should be what he called dual collections. And at the Smithsonian, they called the two collections the People's Museum and the Students' Museum.
Huh.
So the People's Museum was things chosen carefully, displayed in an appealing way, that you could sort of wander through and just everyone could get a sense of what was there and learn from it. And the Students' Museum was where you would go to study things. And you would go back into the storeroom or in some museums into an open area that was available for those who wanted to see more. And you would go and you'd have the opportunity to look at all the specimens, look at all the examples. You didn't have to make them all look good. You could just study them. So that's where that began, that the idea someplace in the end of the 1800s that you would have these two separate collections. Art museums followed up a little later. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts had the idea that you would have the one floor would be everything beautifully displayed, and then the basement, which was open to the public, you could go down there, but everything would be hung tightly together, but everything else would be there for those who really wanted to see all the examples.
So originally, these storerooms were open to the public, and they could view
them.
Many
of them were.
When did that trend to keep the storerooms strictly not open to the public, when did that start?
So as they get more and more crowded, as things become more valuable, starting in the mid-20th century, maybe a little bit earlier, you have the sense that storerooms should be places that only experts get to visit.
Huh.
And that you put a lot of effort into exhibits that are educational rather than just lots of things on display. And you pull things, extra things off, and you put them away for only those who really care. And then as the objects become more valuable, as conservation and preservation becomes a bigger issue, it's just safer and more convenient to have those closed off and locked away. And it also becomes this interesting question of who controls those collections.
Right.
As curators become specialists and publishing about their collections, they have some interest in keeping those collections to themselves.
Well, let's stop and talk about that, because one of the things you describe in this book, and I found this really fascinating, was the emotional connection between curators and the collections. These are the collections they organize. They know them really well, and they become really personal for these curators.
Yes. For many curators, their very deep knowledge of the collections means that they're the ones who can find things, they're the ones who can explain things in a way that no database, no online system will ever be able to do. And there becomes this, I guess, mythology of the curator, but I think a lot of it is true, the sense that there's a special museum sense, this notion of object feel or having a good eye that you can only get by spending a lot of time with your collections, knowing them in a very intimate sort of way, moving them. The folks that I know who understand their collections best are curators who have spent a lot of time packing and unpacking and moving collections and reorganizing them. There's nothing like that sense of deep knowledge that you get from that extended time with the collections. And then, of course, that becomes this personal sense of ownership, which has its downside as well. And many museums have had long battles between directors and curators about who really gets access and who really knows about the collections, how you make them public, but at the same time, take advantage of that good curatorship.
The terms that you use in this book, curatorship, museum sense, and object love, I mean, this really becomes where the private fiefdom of the curator is that backroom collection. And that means, I bet they are loath to put that stuff on view.
It's not so much loath to put it on view, because, in fact, curators are often eager to have their great stuff put on view. It's more of wanting to protect it, saying it's important, wanting to get more of it. So many curators are great acquisitors as well, and they want to bring in more collections. They want to make the case that their part of the museum, their collection, is important, that they need more room, that they need that they so they want to put it on display. It's not that they're hoarding it as a hoarder would. They're hoarding it, or they're holding on to it in order to take good care of it and to know it well. And that can become an object of contention between curators, and then between curators and the parts of the museum that say, these are collections for the public. The most important thing is to make them available.
Well,
it's a practical thing as well. It takes a lot of time to make collections available.
You quote Douglas Greenberg, and he talks about these collections, and he says, in fact, our main business is inventory.
Yes.
That's a pretty controversial quote there. That means that the museum is more interested in collecting and storing than it is in getting stuff on view.
Right. There's a sense, and I think there's something to be said for it, that one of the essential roles of the museum is just to store things, to keep them forever, to say these are important, they should be protected. The way to do that is to store them well. So you get in some museums this sense of deep storage, a term that's used especially in England, where deep storage is we will save it, we'll crate it up, we'll make it secure, and we'll ship it off to an off-site storage.
Right, right.
And we will just make sure that it's protected. It becomes harder to get hold of. It becomes harder sometimes to put on exhibit. But it serves that, you know, those conflicting missions of the museum between preservation and education. Sometimes storage serves that purpose of preservation. And so it's a balancing act, like so many things in the museum world, between how much money and space and time do you put into storage of things, and how much money and space and time do you put into using those things. There are two, I guess you'd call them campaigns going on now. They call themselves campaigns that are sort of show those two conflicting ideas about what it is that museums should be doing. There's a group in the U.S. called, we start with the group in England called the Campaign for Good Curatorship.
Huh.
And there the notion is that deep expertise of curatorship is essential to museums and not fully appreciated. So they talk about how curators who know the collections, know their academic subjects, they know the strengths and weaknesses of what's important, what should be kept, how it should be developed, and that they should be supported. And then sort of on the other side of that division is a group in the U.S. called the Organization or the Campaign for Active Collections. And they're saying, you know, if your museum collections aren't being used, if they're not being taken, you know, used in educational ways, if they're just taking up room, if they're just storage, you should be getting rid of those and acquiring new collections.
Huh.
So many history museums have filled up their collections with 19th century collections, 19th century objects, and there's no room now for collecting the 20th or 21st century. So there's an argument to be made to go back, evaluate what you've got, decide what's worth keeping and what's just taking up space and can be deaccessioned, that is, sold off or used in other ways in the museum, and what really is valuable and should be kept. Not every decision that a curator made 50 or 100 years ago was right.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Stephen Lubar, former museum curator and director who's professor of American Studies at Brown University. And we're continuing our conversation about his new book, which I think is the book to think about how museums function in society. Inside the Lost Museum, Curating Past and Present. And tonight we're talking about the storeroom, the back room. Stephen, when you were talking about the percentage of the collection that's not on view at the beginning of this, and it's this huge amount. How did that evolve where most of a museum's collection, by far, overwhelmingly, is not on view?
Right. So most of those objects that billion objects, something like 900 million of them, are natural history collections. So if there are, well, let's see, a billion objects, 820 million of them, natural science specimens, 200 million of them are archaeological specimens. So those, I don't know, probably tens of millions of beetles are really used as sources for scientific research. Nobody wants to see, they might want to see 100 beetles or 1,000 beetles, but millions of them, they're in storage for scientists to use. So that's the largest piece of that. And natural history museums have always had that large, that sense that you needed a very large collection to understand what a species is, how to do systematics, how to understand nature. 200 million of them are archaeological specimens. Again, not things that mostly end up being useful for display. Those are, again, they're used for scholars, they're used by scientists. It's where you get into the art collections and the historic collections and some of the ethnographic ones where the numbers are smaller, but the argument is made more and more that, in fact, these should be more available, that they shouldn't just be stored away. And so there's where two important things have happened in the museum world in the last 50 years or so. One, of course, is the rise of the Internet, the rise of online collections.
Right.
So the big museums now are saying all of our collections, all those objects in storage, they should be scanned, they should be photographed, and made available to the public. And a place like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the Smithsonian has made a pretty good start in that direction, where just about everything is described and photographed and available online. There's still lots of work to be done. Some smaller museums have a hard time doing that, of course, but there is a way that those collections suddenly develop a new and useful life because anybody anywhere can see what they are and can read that, you know, part of what those curators were doing when they were locked in with those collections for all those decades was writing descriptions of them and describing and telling, explaining what they are. And suddenly that material, that knowledge is easily shared. Well, that's one way that...
Well, can we stay on that for a bit? Because I love these online collections. And I remember interviewing people many years ago on this show who were putting together an online collection of all the objects of the world's museums, all the ancient Greek objects, like papers, archaeological sites. Everything was going to be a one vast online site. Mm-hmm. And what they were talking about is that scholarship was going to change because when you do that, you know, up until before then, only a certain number of scholars or curators in the know who had connections with museums got to see all the objects, and it was very few. And then they would write about what their particular tastes were. But now that the stuff was available to a much wider audience, scholarship became much more democratic. Mm-hmm. And that has an interesting effect. It's really fascinating to see how scholarship can change now these collections are online.
Right. And the collections get used in all sorts of interesting ways that traditional scholars and curators would never have thought about.
So what's number two?
So that's number one, the online thing. The other is the notion of open storage, the idea that you display your storage. This became popular started in the 1970s, and then in the 1980s and 90s, a good number of museums said, we've got all this stuff in storage. What we'll do is put it out on display, sort of like that older notion of the student's museum, where you would have it densely packed but available. So the Metropolitan Museum of Art did a open storage display of its American collections, where just about everything that wasn't on display elsewhere in the museum was available for the public to see in a densely packed exhibition. And again, the computers made some of this much more interesting, in that you could have the museum's collections database available in that spot, and you could see what was there and understand what it was. A number of museums, the Brooklyn Museum, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the National Portrait Gallery, they did this not as quite as thoroughly with all of their collections, but putting a lot of material out there and in some ways backing off this curatorial sense of these are mine,
yep,
and backing off the curatorial sense of we need to explain things for the public, but you know, just let them appreciate it on their own as objects. And it's not clear that this has been completely successful. A number of museums that had done it have backed away from it a little bit or have thought about new ways to display it. It turns out that even open storage carries with it how you what order you put things in or what's next to each other. There's a story there. And in some cases, that's not been a successful story, an anthropology museum, say. And then from the other side, there's been curators who have said, it's not doing our job if we just put everything out there. Our job is to use these collections, to use our knowledge of these collections,
right,
to teach with. And so it's an ongoing debate. And there's, it's very appealing to have everything out there. On the other hand, it's very appealing to offer curators a chance to say, I understand this, let me help you understand it.
One of the things you sort of alluded to earlier, and we only have a few minutes left, and we're not even going to finish this chapter, the idea of deaccessioning. That's got to be one of the most controversial things that a museum can do. And as a matter of fact, right now, in the news, there's the Norman Rockwell Museum out in the Berkshires.
The Berkshire Museum,
who's deaccessioning several Norman Rockwell paintings. And it's incredibly controversial.
It is. It's in court right now. There's been decisions just in the last few days about what's happening. So let me back up on deaccessioning, because like you say, it's controversial. And in some ways, it really shouldn't be. And that's because in the way it's often reported, two separate things are mixed together. One is deaccessioning, which means pruning the collection, which is good museum policy. Like I said, not everything serves the mission of the museum as well as it ought to. And then there's what you do with the funds from deaccessioning. So if you sell a Norman Rockwell and it's worth a lot of money, and you use that money to buy other artwork that is either more keeping with the museum mission or moving the museum in a direction that's important for it to go, that's fine. That's good museum curatorship. The real debate is what happens when you sell off your artwork to keep the lights on in the museum.
Right.
To build the endowment to keep the museum open. And for the official policy from museum organizations, the American Alliance of Museums, the American Association of Art Museum Directors, is that's bad. The shorthand is, the museum is there to save the collection. The collection's not there to save the museum. I should say this is a fairly new idea about collections. 50 years ago, this was not a topic that people were so concerned about. And there's an argument that has been made, mostly not by museum people, but by economists and others, that in fact, this is a, if museums really are about education, that should be balanced with the value of the collections that are in storage and not being used for the mission of the museum. So it's a topic that is hotly debated, not the idea of pruning and focusing the collection, but how to use the funds from that pruning and focusing.
We literally only have 2 minutes left, but one of the things that happens is the public gets involved and sort of feels like, okay, this painting was there for me. You know, I always got to see it when I went to my museum, mm-hmm, and it's no longer going to be there for me.
Right. And that is partly, that's a wonderful thing that the public feels ownership. as museums grow and change, it's sometimes for the larger good of a larger public, maybe the folks who aren't going to the museum right now, a new audience that isn't connected to the present way the museum's working, to say, you know, we need to get rid of some of those paintings that our present audience cares about and think about new audiences and what objects we should bring in to tell their story. And so that's where it's important that the museum know what its mission is, that it know what its audience is interested in, what its audiences might be interested in if it did a better job of reaching out to them. And then finally making that case, you know, through the newspaper, through the museum's publicity to say, we are thoughtfully deciding to get rid of objects that don't meet our quality standards or don't meet our mission or aren't as useful as other things to meet our mission, so that we can reach a better audience in a better way.
We could talk about this book for years, Steve. It's like there's so much on it. Again, we've just been talking about one section of the book, one little section. My returning guest tonight has been Stephen Lubar, former museum curator and director, who's professor of American Studies at Brown University. And again, continuing our conversation about Inside the Lost Museum, Curating Past and Present. And trust me, this is one of the most interesting books you'll read about how museums work. Stephen, it's been a pleasure.
Been a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.